Hello and welcome to another edition of Business Matters here on Highland Radio with me, Chris Ashmore. Coming up in this week's program, I'll be speaking to Derry-based financial journalist and economic commentator Paul Gosling about his new book, A New Ireland, A Five-Year Review, which considers what preparation has been made for a potential referendum on the constitutional future of Ireland. He looks at how the economies north and south compare and examines areas ranging from health, education, water and the public sector to the all-island economy, the subvention conversation and much, much more. Are we ready for a referendum on a united Ireland? And what could some of the implications be for a border county like Donegal? Well, this book certainly provides some very useful and interesting insights, so do stay tuned. But first, let's start with the Donegal hat trick. The Greencastle-based firm Seabound Engineering, which we have featured on this programme in the past, well, it's celebrating having won the recent Best Export Award at the National Enterprise Awards. The boat builder, which is supported by Local Enterprise Office Donegal, was among the big winners at this year's National Enterprise Awards in the Mansion House in Dublin. Seabound Engineering is a specialist manufacturer of custom-built aluminium vessels for the aquaculture and marine sectors. And the company has built a strong international reputation for its innovation, design excellence, and indeed high quality construction. It's currently Ireland's only SCMS certified aluminium shipyard, and it exports vessels ranging in value from €120,000 to €3.2 million across a growing range of industries that include agriculture, tourism, and indeed search and rescue. And this marks the third consecutive year that a Donegal business has been recognised at the National Enterprise Awards. They follow in the footsteps of wins by Living Green in 2024 and Silverstrand Ropeworks in 2023. Incidentally, all three proudly representing Inishowen. So congratulations are extended to Thomas Havlin, the CEO, John McColgan, the manager of Seabound Engineering, and all the staff there. Well, are we ready for a referendum on Irish unity? And what would it mean for people in Donegal, for businesses, for our health services, schools, the public sector? The list goes on and on. Financial journalist and economic commentator Paul Gosling has just written a new book called A New Ireland, A Five-Year Review. And the book is published by Columbkill Press in Derry. The official launch will take place in the Rossmore Business Park there on the 26th of June. Now, I've been fortunate to get an advanced copy of the book, and it is full of very interesting facts and comparisons between North and South, ranging from healthcare to water, the environment, policing, education, the subvention that the North gets from Britain. A lot more on top of that. Well, Paul has considered in this book what progress has been made in preparation for a potential referendum on the constitutional future of this island, and asks questions about Stormont and its future. Earlier this week, I spoke with Paul to find out more about the book and to discuss it in some detail. Paul, I just want to say, first of all, when I got a copy of this, I sat down, started to read it. I took out a highlighter pen, which is something I do not normally do when it comes to books. But straight away, there were a number of facts that really jumped out at me. And let's face it, when it comes to discussing things north and south, so many people out there know little bits and pieces. But to get a sort of an overall picture of where we are and the road down towards a united Ireland, it's a somewhat cloudy picture, I can suggest.
Yeah, and that's really the purpose of the book. It's to answer two questions, one of which is, to what extent are we on any sort of road towards a referendum? And secondly, what are the differences between the North and the South, and how do you overcome those? And I think a fact-based approach is the best way to deal with this. We do have a significant problem in Northern Ireland, which is that Stormont really isn't performing very well. That's most obvious with the health services. But generally, we have a problem across quite a lot of public services and infrastructure areas.
And as you point out in the book, the Good Friday Agreement, now more than 27 years ago, we live in a much changed society, both north and south, since it was signed.
Yeah, and it's been a bit disappointing in lots of ways. I mean, I arrived in Northern Ireland a few months after the Good Friday Agreement was signed, and I expected at that time, perhaps naively, that things would be much improved compared to where they are today. In a sense, the Good Friday Agreement has been more successful for the south than it has for the north. The Irish Republic has boomed in general terms. I mean, we had the 2008 financial crash, but generally it's been an upward trend for the economy of the Republic of Ireland. But really, Northern Ireland has been pretty stagnant. I mean, in some respects, Belfast has done quite well, but the good times haven't been spread evenly across Northern Ireland. And we've still got significant levels of poverty, deprivation, both in Belfast and in particular in Derry and Strabane. And so I think all of us felt that things would be a lot better. And of course, it's not just about the economy. It's also about peace. We haven't got rid of paramilitaries, in particular the Lloyds paramilitaries, and they still damage our society. And that can be seen in particular in the East, I think, in terms of the attacks on inward migration, you know, ethnic minorities arriving in Northern Ireland. There's a lot of antagonism within some parts of the communities. And these are problems that, as I say, we would have expected. We were focused, I think, in the time of the Good Friday Agreement on relationships between Protestants and Catholics, between Unionists and Nationalists and Republicans. And we now have a large third community, and we haven't really fully resolved issues in terms of the relationship between nationalism and unionism. But equally, we haven't got to terms with the influx of new populations.
Yes, because that was something I was just going to bring up with you. First of all, you know, is there an assumption out there that when you have two states or two countries coming together, if you have a new united country, is it always necessarily for the better?
Well, I mean, there's different trends there, aren't there? I mean, changing constitutional relationships comes with risks, and that goes either way. So you can see, for example, with the former Soviet Union, that when it broke up, it was more peaceful than the breakup of Yugoslavia, but it has caused lots of problems. And similarly, in Germany, you've got unification, and it's generally been successful, but that's 30 years in the making, and there's still significant differences between the West and the East. And so I think if you look at what has happened elsewhere, that gives you a few warning signs, not that you shouldn't do it, but you should be aware that you can't expect instant success. It's a difficult process. But equally, Northern Ireland is in such a bad place in lots of regards that it does offer quite a lot of opportunities, unity.
Now, you've touched on the fact that the southern economy has done pretty well over the last few decades. If it goes to a referendum, demographics coming into play here, and if we go back 20, 30 years ago, there was a fairly clear line between the nationalist and unionist community in the north, and not so much in terms of those who describe themselves as being Northern Irish. Just give us a little bit of detail there of how things really have changed in that regard.
Well, we've got a significantly different demographic in terms of the comparison between unionism stroke Protestantism and, on the other hand, Catholicism stroke nationalism and republicanism. I mean, the weight of the population is very much in favour of Catholics rather than Protestants, though not necessarily those who worship every Sunday, but in terms of the, you know, where the community background. And the reality is that the Protestant and Unionist population tends to be older, therefore more of them die. And by contrast, more of the Catholic population is younger, so it's growing. So you now have not simply Sinn Féin, the largest party within the Northern Ireland Assembly, but you have a significantly larger population that is nominally Catholic than you do that are Protestant. A lot of those are children, not yet of voting age, but clearly the demographic trend is in favour of nationalism, republicanism, than it compared with unionism. That's assuming that Catholics vote for Irish unity and Protestants vote against it, which is perhaps an oversimplification. But that is the general trend. But when we had the Good Friday Agreement, as I said before, we largely had two populations. We had the Catholic population, which is also nationalist and Republican, and we had the Protestant population, which was unionist. But now we have had a big influx of other people. I'm one of those. I'm neither Catholic nor Protestant. I'm neither from the South nor from the North. And while I might be not entirely typical, there has been this very significant other population coming into Northern Ireland, and to an extent that is reflected in the growth of the Alliance Party, which is, you could might say, neither one thing nor the other. And so that is a general change in the makeup of the population of Northern Ireland.
And just remind us again, if we are to have a referendum down the road, what is the likely format to be, and what sort of majority would be required?
It has to be a simple majority. I mean, there have been conversations about whether that's the right thing to do. Ian Paisley Jr. Put forward a motion inside the House of Commons seeking what's called a supermajority. And come to that, the former SDLP deputy leader, Seamus Mullen, also talked in his autobiography of the need for a supermajority. And the idea is that if you had a simple majority, then you might have the same situation as you got with Brexit, where you have a lot of dissatisfaction after the result. But the reality is that if you had anything other than a simple majority, you'd be weighting it and you'd be saying that the vote on one side is worth more than the vote on the other. So it will be a simple majority. All you need is 50% plus one in the referendum in the North. But equally, the parties will be seeking to get a larger majority. They don't want a situation where you've had with Brexit that Brexit had, 5% or so clear majority. But with Brexit, there's been a lot of feeling afterwards, well, if we'd known more, then we wouldn't have voted that way, we would have voted the other way. And you don't want that type of nagging discontent in society. You want to have a clear outcome that carries a clear majority of the population with you.
So all the more reason to have a debate for people to see the facts as they are. And fair to say, both sides of the border, there are numerous issues. Perhaps you can just touch on some of the changes. Am I right in saying people in the South, we look often at the NHS and think, oh, the NHS is a great system. Our system here is in a real mess. But when you delve into the figures, the North, when I was reading your book, I was actually shocked in terms like waiting lists, just how bad things are in the North with regard to the health service there.
Absolutely. I mean, I was talking to a health professional in Dublin a few days ago who was saying, oh, but, you know, the NHS in Northern Ireland is so much better than we have in the HSE. And I said, no, it's not. You just don't actually understand how bad things are in Northern Ireland. I've been on the waiting list for a hernia operation for 7 years. That is not untypical. I mean, people with mental health problems have been on waiting lists for decades. It's not uncommon to be on a waiting list for 10 years for certain treatments. And the result of that is that a lot of people who can afford to do so will pay privately or they will take out private health insurance. So in a sense, the structural differences between the NHS in Northern Ireland and the system in the South, where you've got private healthcare insurance for a significant chunk of the population, that difference is narrowing. But in the meantime, waiting lists for public treatment in the South are shorter than they are in the North. Obviously, it varies according to the ailment, the difficulties. But actually, it is wrong to think that the North has a better system than the South. It's got a different system. It offers some opportunities for better outcomes, but not necessarily. have a lot of people in the in the Republic who have free treatment, who have free use of GPs, free access to GPs, free prescriptions, free use of hospitals. So it is not a clear-cut difference in which you would say Northern Ireland is better. Theoretically, the system in Northern Ireland is better. In practice, the system in Northern Ireland is in deep crisis.
Now, a number of other areas that you go through in your book, we can touch on them, not in any particular order, but housing and water. Again, here in the south, we have a housing crisis. We're hearing a lot at the moment about maybe using some of this Apple kitty towards investing in our infrastructure to a greater degree, particularly in getting money for Uisce Éireann, that's Irish Water, to provide the infrastructure there for the hundreds of thousands of new homes that will be needed over the next few years. But in the north, again, housing and water, these are big, big issues.
Yeah, I think it's probably fair to say, Chris, that the housing crisis is worse in the south than it is in the north, but there is a crisis in the north of underprovision. And the water infrastructure is worse in the north than it is in the south, but it is problematic, obviously, in the Republic as well. And some of this touches on quite similar issues, which is the fact that politicians will not agree to water charges. And without water charges, then there is no clarity about how you ring fence investment into the water infrastructure. Now, that is down the line causing problems, potentially, especially in Dublin, for new housing development in the Republic. But in the north, we're already there. We have housing developments that are stalled and have been for some time because we don't have the water infrastructure, in particular the sewerage infrastructure, in place. So it creates limits on new housing, particularly social housing, but also in other economic developments for new business parks, etc. You can't build them unless you've got water supplies and water outflows, and we have not got those across the Northern Ireland, and we haven't got any form of guaranteed funding to provide the capital infrastructure that's needed.
A United Ireland would affect every single person on this island, no matter what you're doing. There's going to be, it's all going to filter down. Your day-to-day life is going to change. We haven't even touched on the fiscal side of things. Who knows what way taxes may change. On a positive note, education, north and south, if you compare us with many countries around the world, we score fairly well in that regard. But higher levels of third-level education in the south, and that is important as well in terms of attracting foreign direct investment and looking to the future from a business point of view.
Absolutely. I think, Chris, it's recognised that the Republic of Ireland has three strong benefits which attract inward investment from other countries. One of those, obviously, is the low tax rate. But equally important, perhaps more important, is the skills base. I mean, no one's going to invest in a country unless they're confident that the skills there. And the third element is English speaking. So both North and the South have the advantage for US investment or Canadian investment, come to that, of it being an English speaking country. But the fact that the skills investment from the Republic of Ireland has been so effective really helps the Irish economy no end. And that's, you know, to an extent, that's about the number of graduates in the population, which, and the South outscores the North substantially in that regard. Also about vocational skills, even though the South needs more, the North also needs far more. But more than anything, it's the schooling system. We have far too many teenagers that, in effect, drop out of the schooling system in Northern Ireland. And the South had that problem, but it's addressed it. And in the North, we're a long way behind in terms of that. And that's very important in terms of productivity, getting enough people into work and having people to fill the jobs that are available.
And on productivity, I note that you state in the book that productivity per worker in 2020 was approximately 40% higher in the Republic compared to the North. That's a pretty startling difference.
Yeah, and part of that is about the skills difference. It's also partly about the number of people that are not available for work because they are outside of the labour market in Northern Ireland. But the other thing is that because the Republic has attracted so much inward investment, in particular from the United States, a lot of those businesses that have come in are high productivity businesses. So it's a second degree, if you like, benefit for the Republic, which is off the back of having got investors in. They've got investors in that are high productivity businesses. So you've got the skills base, but you've also got the investment, and that drives up productivity no end.
Now, we can't have a talk about what lies ahead between North and South without mentioning the public sector. And I think a lot of people here in the South would be aware of the fact that the public sector makes up a higher proportion of those people working in, than in the South. Again, maybe if you can just elaborate on this, because this is pretty significant.
It is, absolutely. And some of this dates back to the Troubles, when you weren't getting private sector investment into Northern Ireland, and the difference was made up by recruiting more people into the public sector. And we haven't had the major shift in the makeup of the population and the job arrangements that might have been expected following the Good Friday Agreement. So yes, we've got this hangover of significant public sector, but in my opinion, and I've worked with Instalment, my opinion is that the political infrastructure of Northern Ireland is not adept at making difficult decisions. So there's not been that reforming of public service delivery that you would expect. That has happened in the Republic. So we have substantially higher levels of public sector employment in Northern Ireland than there is in anywhere else, either in Ireland or in the United Kingdom. And that's one of the things that you would want to address as part of Irish unity. And I think it's also important to say, Chris, that the potential advantages of Irish unity to an extent are around improving the economies of scale, making services on both sides of the border work better. So if you look particularly with the health service, you've got obviously an infrastructure of hospitals, but if you can actually have more use of specialization across both sides of the border, if you can have centers of excellence which are available for patients across the whole of the island, then you're going to have better outcomes at lower cost.
Well, during any debate on a topic of such magnitude, and certainly Brexit springs to mind here, there could be a fair degree of scaremongering. I am quite sure, and I know many people in the North, really, the thought of paying 50, 60, 70 euro to go and visit your GP is something that they are certainly worried about. Likewise, from the Southern point of view, we hear a lot about this, the deficit that the North has, and there's figures thrown around. I think the sort of the general one is that the North is subsidised to the tune of 10 to 12 billion a year, and if we've united Ireland, well, who's going to pay for that? So these are the sort of things that are going to come out in when it starts getting into a little bit of really lively debate.
Absolutely. I think it's important to stress that we should be talking about a medium-term project. It's not like switching a light on and off. As I've said before, German unity has taken 30 years so far. The transfer of Hong Kong, I think, took 13 years. I mean, it's not something that should be done simply and expect that everyone gets the same outcome the day after we've got a vote. So it's a process. And part of the process that's already happening in the South is the move towards a different structure of health service. So there's been agreement in principle towards Sláintecare. That is gradually being implemented, and that is an attempt to move closer to an NHS-style healthcare delivery. And so, yes, we have got a fiscal deficit in Northern Ireland, which is very significant, and yes, we've got a different structure of health service delivery. But I think the logical thing to do is to move towards harmonisation on these things over a period of time. And in terms of the fiscal deficit in Northern Ireland, one would hope that the United Kingdom government would be generous in supporting its own population moving to a different constitutional outcome, and it would help the process along financially as well as politically.
What happens to Stormont and moving forward, and do we have some sort of federal structure, or what are your own thoughts on that?
Yeah, and that is one of the reasons why I was keen to write this book. Having worked in Stormont for a couple of years, it seems to me that it cannot work. It's not only that it does not work, I do not believe it can work. And I'm very concerned that there is a certain lazy conversation taking place that you'd simply retain Stormont within a federalised Irish state. And I was pretty shocked when I spoke to a committee of the Seanad a couple of years ago, and it seemed to me that the view amongst the senators that I spoke to was, well, obviously you'd keep Stormont within a united Ireland, and that seems to me completely absurd, to be blunt about it, because the Stormont isn't failing to deliver. It is failing to provide proper management of public services. It's unable to take difficult decisions. Why that would change under a different constitutional arrangement is completely beyond me. I think, yes, I am in favour of Irish unity, but it has to involve ending Stormont. Yes, you need to make certain changes. It's not simply that Irish unity would involve the existing Irish state, you know, with Northern Ireland bolted on. There would have to be significant changes to the operations of the Irish state compared to where we are today. But equally, we cannot have the retention of Stormont within a new state. It would just be, the purpose for Northern Ireland of Irish unity is to create a functioning modern state that runs effective and successful public services. And you can't do that with Stormont. And you wouldn't change that by simply retaining Stormont within a new Irish state.
Is there any movement or any likelihood that we could ever see an independent Northern Ireland, given that you just have to look at the map of Europe and we have many small nation states that have emerged in the last 20, 30, 40 years, from Slovenia to Macedonia, Estonia, all with quite small populations as well?
Yeah, I mean, no one's ever put forward a convincing case for an independent Northern Ireland, nor would it solve the communal tensions within Northern Ireland. I mean, it hasn't got the economic basis for being a self-sustaining, self-governing state. I mean, the fact that we've got a significant a fiscal deficit, there are differences in calculations about how you stated, but I mean, you know, we have got a significant fiscal deficit in Northern Ireland, and that would not change simply becoming independent, not unless you basically eliminated all social welfare. So no, there's never going to be an independent Northern Ireland. That just wouldn't make any sense.
And have we had many opinion polls asking people just, you know, what would they be prepared to pay for United Ireland, insofar as would they accept bigger taxes, would they accept cuts in certain services? Because one of the things that I suspect, and again back to Brexit, and there can be spin put on different things. We've already seen different reports. The likes of Professor John Doyle from Dublin City University has certainly made some interesting comments on what way he sees things going in the north. Likewise, Professor John Fitzgerald of the RSI, and you know, they've differing opinions, both very highly respected academics in their own right. So ultimately, people will have to make up their own minds. But it will be difficult to sort of get the full picture and to be 100% accurate about everything, because going forward, there's much that we just do not know how it will evolve.
Well, we have an opportunity to learn from the mistakes of Brexit. In particular, advocates of leaving the European Union argued at one point, some argued, oh, we would stay within the customs union and the single market, and others said we would leave. And it was unclear when people voted whether we'd actually stay within the customs union and the single market or whether we'd leave. And that's a pretty fundamental difference of understanding. So that type of difference of interpretation we have the opportunity to not make those same mistakes in the debate around Irish unity. In terms of the difference of opinion over the fiscal deficit, the views taken by John Fitzgerald on one hand and John Doyle on the other, I mean, those aren't simply differences of opinion. They are differences in expectation, differences of assumptions. So John Doyle is assuming that the UK will continue to honour pensions liabilities of its former citizens and former employees. And John Fitzgerald is assuming that it won't. So that is something that can be clarified before there is a vote. It doesn't have to be an outstanding difference. And there are other things as well. So, for example, John Fitzgerald is assuming that you would instantly pretty well have an uplift of benefits in Northern Ireland to match the rates of benefits in the South, whereas it's quite likely that you'd do something on a gradualized basis so you didn't instantly uprate benefits and pensions in Northern Ireland to match those in the South. So again, those are things which you wouldn't need to be making assumptions before a vote. You would need clarity around them. And that really is part of the purpose of the book, is to try and encourage people to provide clarity on those differences of opinion. And the point you raise about the opinion poll, Chris, is very important, which is that in particular, the Irish Times opinion polling has indicated that is a soft support for Irish unity within the Republic. And if people are told it's going to cost you an arm and a leg, they think, well, maybe actually I don't want it right now, but let's put it off for a bit. So again, we need to have clarity over these things. But equally, we're not going to have a referendum this week.
I'm speaking with financial journalist and economic commentator Paul Gosling about his new book, A New Ireland, a five-year review looking ahead at, while not inevitable, but the likelihood that we're going to have a referendum on Irish unity in the not-too-distant future. If you were to put a timescale on it, Paul, do you think it's within the next 10 years?
I would say probably on balance around 10 years. I mean, it's interesting that the political leaderships are differing on this. Micheál Martin seems to be keen for a slow walk. Leo Varadkar is keen for things to be at a faster trot. So there are interesting dynamics within the political classes.
And what about regional and geographical factors? Would I be right in saying a county like Donegal, if there was a referendum, the outcome could be quite different to people voting in Kerry or Wexford because of our proximity to the border?
I think there are indications that the further people are away from the border, the less they feel it is relevant to them. And I think it's reasonable to make an argument that Irish unity, could, in terms of the southern population, could particularly benefit Donegal. I mean, I think we all recognise that Donegal is not simply physically at a distance from Dublin, but also tends to get neglected in terms of Dublin, in the same way that Derry tends to get neglected by Belfast. And you can certainly see that if you had integration constitutionally in the northwest, that it could potentially benefit the populations on both sides of the border.
And likewise, areas like transport, if it was a united Ireland, maybe our road and rail system would look quite different to what it is now.
Well, you'd certainly hope there would be greater rail investment, but I think also you'd expect to see a significant restructuring of the health service on the two sides of the border. I mean, yeah, we have a really first-class arrangement for cancer care in Altmagelvin, which is available to the population of Donegal. But it begs the question, why don't we do that much more with a lot of other services within the healthcare system? And I think you would want to have a significant restructuring in border areas right along the border, in particular around healthcare and perhaps about some other services as well.
There is a shared island fund, perhaps maybe not doing as much as some people would have liked. What is the general feeling amongst the unionist population towards the shared island fund? And is it, again, a little bit of a slow burner?
Well, I think the Taoiseach in particular is very concerned about avoiding putting unionist noses out of joint. And so the shared island funds have been, as much as possible, avoiding controversy and avoiding upsetting unionists. And clearly there are differences of opinion within unionism. The DUP would be less willing to be involved in cross-border activities than the Ulster unionists, for example. And there is a willingness, and I was at a conference in Dublin a few days ago where the health minister, Mike Nesbitt from Northern Ireland, was talking favourably about cross-border cooperation around healthcare and sees the opportunities for improving service outcomes and reducing the costs of service provision. So you can see there's a pragmatic unionism that's willing to be involved in more cross-border cooperation. But, you know, unionists are never going to agree to an outcome that's not favourable to unionism.
And there could be a few surprises in the mix in the likes of Reform UK. If Nigel Farage is in 10 Downing Street, his outlook on the North, where do we feel he stands at the moment in relation to the Good Friday Agreement and indeed a referendum on Irish unity?
Well, he's in alliance with more right-wing unionist politicians within Northern Ireland. So on one level, you would expect him to be negative towards Irish unity. But Reform UK is more than anything, it's an English nationalist outlook. And English nationalism doesn't really care anything about Northern Ireland. So there would be a lot of pressure within a Reform UK government towards basically focusing much more on England and much less, not just on Northern Ireland, but also on Scotland and Wales. And bear in mind that the spend per person in England is significantly below that of Wales and Scotland, as well as in Northern Ireland. And so you would expect a Reform UK government to be keen to change the dynamics more in favour of England, less in favour of other areas. And it is quite possible that it could lead to a vote for Irish unity. But the other thing about this, of course, is that there are other elements of this, that the Reform UK is very keen to leave the arrangements around the European Court of Justice, and that underpins the Good Friday Agreement. So if you have a government of Reform UK that basically is demanding the rewriting of an international agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, then that creates a lot of difficulties. So I think that if we do have a Reform UK government, then that will actually significantly increase the demands for Irish unity.
And yet, I wouldn't be very confident that they would be too generous in terms of winding down that fiscal deficit. And things could be a little bit harsher in that regard.
Yes, that's right. But equally, of course, I mean, if you look internationally, political organisations that are close to Donald Trump have tended to lose out in subsequent elections. You've certainly seen that in Canada, though there are differences in terms of elements within Eastern Europe have achieved greater popularity because of their similarity with outlook to Donald Trump. We all know that Nigel Farage is close to Donald Trump, so how that would work in terms of the politics is unclear. But as things stand, Reform UK is very well positioned, and as you say, is unlikely to be supportive to Irish nationalists of any form.
Well, Paul, the book, A New Ireland, a five-year review, is going to be launched on the 26th of June. We wish you every success with that. Reaction to date so far, I think you've generated quite a bit of debate already.
Yes, and it's been very helpful, very good, and a lot of support for the book. So that's reassuring.
Well, my thanks to Paul Gosling for joining me on Business Matters this week. His book, A New Ireland, A Five-Year Review, is published by Columbkill Press in Derry. That's it for this week's programme. As always, thanks for listening. I wish you a very healthy, happy and profitable week ahead. Until the next time, from me, Chris Ashmore, goodbye.